This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm Katie.
What is happening, Katie?
Well, you know this. Lots of people in my personal life know this, but it is time to finally announce it to our listeners. Katie got into grad school.
Ooh,
Katie
ooh.
Got into grad school.
Ooh,
yes, that is right. I am going back to school. Online, of course, of course.
I'm so excited for you.
I'm so fucking pumped. It's for a master's in clinical mental health counseling, which is going to be so great. I'm super pumped. This is the thing I have been working on, and it's finally here. So don't worry, nothing is happening with the podcast.
Oh my God, yes. No, we're still going to do all of this at the same time.
Of course. But yes, very, very excited.
If I can do two campaigns, you can also do school while we do this.
Yeah, this will be fine. This will be great.
I'm so excited for you, and God, I wish you would be my counselor, but that's a conflict of interest.
Yeah, sorry, can't do that. Might be.
We already counsel each other anyway, it's okay.
We're all good. So yeah, I think the only thing that'll mean for the podcast is that our episodes are going to be recorded a little bit more in advance.
Yes. At least we're going to try to make that happen.
We might be in a little bit of a time machine, either all the time or sometimes.
We'll see how it goes.
We'll see what happens. We'll see. What about you? How are you? How are things?
I'm pretty good. Last night, I gave a speech at the Somerset County Democratic nominating convention.
Hell yeah.
We had it here in Manville. Actually, okay, I love this though. So this event last year was my introduction to this political sphere.
Oh, shit.
It's where I met, like, all of my committee members. I had only met Roberta, like, twice before. It's where I got nominated for council last year. It's where I got nominated for council this year.
Hell yeah.
But we always have it in Manville. We have it at the VFW, which, as Katie knows, I go there weekly on Friday nights for Friday night dinners there with my committee members. And it's always a fantastic time. We're always shutting the place down. We're having a grand old time. I think we bring the vibe.
Hell yeah.
To the place. But it's also where that's like our emergency center. In floods, in different kinds of emergencies and everything. So it's a really important place for us. So every year they ask for someone from Manville to give the welcome speech and to introduce our county chair. And that was me last night. So it was really exciting. And if you guys want to check out my speech, most of it, Jessica only missed like the first two sentences of it, but most of it I just posted on Instagram.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was really cool. I was a little nervous, but then once I got up there, I was like, I'm in a room full of people who feel the same exact way as I do, more or less, about our future and the state of the world. So I was like, no, I'm in a safe place to be saying these words.
Absolutely.
That was really exciting, especially because like... the county chair picked me to do that, and she's an incredibly strong and inspiring woman. I was selected for this. So it was really, like, an incredible honor.
You're an incredibly strong and inspiring woman. Let's be real here. You got us an interview with a congresswoman.
I did do that.
It's Women's History Month. Let's acknowledge this history being made right here.
Oh my God, you're literally going to make me cry right
okay,
now.
Okay, no, we can't cry. No more crying on this episode.
I think that should lead us into talking about our next incredibly strong and courageous and inspiring woman.
Absolutely.
From the depths of the Great Lakes to the shadows of its national forests, Michigan has centuries worth of deadly secrets buried deep. Violent Ends is here to dig them up.
Once known as the murder capital of the world, Michigan was the first English-speaking territory on the planet to abolish the death penalty.
It's where the only American monarch in history, who also happened to be a cult leader, was crowned.
And where one of the most credible UFO sightings in the world occurred.
It's where Al Capone and John Dillinger and all of their best
good buddies hid out from the long arm of the law.
And where we hold an annual parade to drive out a supernatural harbinger of doom that looks like a little red devil with a beer belly.
Hosted by award-winning author and true crime connoisseur Jen Carpenter, Violent Ends explores the dark side of Michigan's history, from the dark and disturbing to the just plain weird.
Episodes are released every other Tuesday and are available wherever you get your podcasts. So, I'll be super real. Before doing any of this research, if anyone asked me about Hedy Lamarr, I wouldn't have known who you were talking about. There are a ton of iconic images of her that I remembered after, like, I saw them while doing research. I remembered those from, like, my Tumblr days.
I feel like there's a lot of those with, like, maybe quotes from her or things about her accomplishments that get shared every Women's History Month.
Definitely. Definitely. But she's not, like, talked about on kind of a grand scheme the way I feel like she should be.
Mm-hmm.
So today we're going to talk about the mother of Wi-Fi, whom, before a fucking BuzzFeed list, I had never heard of.
Thanks, BuzzFeed, for your listicles.
Right? A lot of this information is coming from the documentary Bombshell, The Hedy Lamarr Story, which you could rent on Apple, and I highly recommend it. In that documentary, journalist Fleming Meeks in 2016 found four tapes that he had, like, accidentally hidden on himself in his office. And these were kind of like a semi-lost interview with Hedy from the 1990s when she was 76.
Wow.
Right? Okay, we're gonna somehow need to figure out a way to, like, show what is happening right now with my fucking cat.
I am not recording the video. Katie's cat is fully climbing her like a fucking jungle gym.
Yeah, get... Okay.
Who is that, Pete?
That's Pete.
Get out of here, Pete.
Seriously, he's so needy. So in the documentary Bombshell, there are a lot of these unheard interviews that get played throughout it. It's really, really interesting. A lot of amazing quotes of her kind of talking about her life. So I have a lot of quotes from that, and then all other sources can be found in our show notes. Hedy was born Hedwig Eva Maria Keisler.
I love the name Hedwig.
Right?
I love that.
It's amazing. Which is where Hedy comes from. And she's born November 9th, 1914. We're talking about a long time ago. She's described in pretty much every source as an Austrian-born American film actress and inventor. Which, of course, she's listed as actress first, and not the mother of fucking Wi-Fi, which is what she gets called in the tech industry. Because for so much of her life, she wasn't really accepted for her brain, but rather her beauty.
Shocker in that time, right? Always needing to diminish the hard work of women.
Of course. And she goes through a lot. Trigger warning, Nazis, Hitler, World Wars, to be honest. She has a long life. She died in the year 2000. Her life spans a very long time. Back to her childhood. Hedy was born the only child of wealthy, assimilated Jewish parents in Vienna. I mention the religious aspect of it because of the time period and the location.
Mm-hmm.
Hedy was incredibly close with her father, Emil. He was professionally a banker, but his interests in the things around him had no limits, which led him to raise an incredibly curious daughter. By the time she was five, Hedy had taken apart her music box and put it back together again. Which is so fucking cool.
I love that so much.
Just like this little girl in 1919, like, taking shit apart. It's amazing.
I think maybe we will start recording the video for this, because sometimes I wish people could just see how little things like that that you mentioned, like, I just put a huge, massive smile on my face. Sometimes I forget to audibly respond.
It's hard because you and I are just used to talking like FaceTime, so we forget that this is being recorded sometimes. By the time that she was a teenager, she began to pursue acting in Vienna, where she did land some roles in some movies, but didn't become world famous for a few more years. At 18, she became notorious for running across the screen naked and, God forbid, simulating an orgasm in the film Ecstasy.
God forbid.
God forbid.
Oh my God, a normal thing. Oh my God, something that doctors were doing to women when they thought that they were hysterical during that time? Okay, yeah, let's shame her for that. Sure.
Not in 1920, God forbid. This scene led the movie to be condemned by the Pope.
Who gives a fuck what he says?
in 1920, everyone. It was also later banned by Hitler, but not because of that scene, but because Hedy was Jewish. In 1934, at the age of 19, she married her first husband, 33-year-old Fritz Mandl. That made him 14 years older than her.
I don't even need to speak my feelings because y'all know.
Oh, just wait. Pulitzer Prize winning author Richard Rhodes, love that alliteration, who I quote many times throughout my notes, describes the relationship as such. Quote, Lamar always loved science, but spent most of her early adult life trying to escape an unhappy marriage to an Austrian arms dealer.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Not just a regular 14-year-old gap in a relationship with an arms dealer.
The fucking arms dealer. Oh, boy.
The next quote we have from Rhodes is, quote, he gave her jewels, he gave her gold, he gave her everything she could possibly want except her freedom. End quote. They lived in a country house with 25 guest homes, living a complete life of luxury. However, Mandl would often host banquets for other rich people, which included the German government.
Oh.
And Hedy's job was to sit there and be beautiful, but she was clearly fucking bored. I'm texting you a picture that we'll put on the Instagram. This is her and her husband at dinner.
Bro. You could just, the eyes give it away. The yeah. eyes tell all. She is bored out of her goddamn mind.
Yeah, it's real bad.
Oh, I feel bad for her. Also, obsessed with her eyebrows.
Yes.
Just want to put that out there.
When the World War started, Hedy's husband began manufacturing weapons for the Germans. Something she acknowledges in the taped interview. And what she had to say was, he never even let me come into the factory.
Mm.
Which is kind of a weird way of putting it, especially considering Hedy was Jewish. Like, why would she want to go into it? Yeah. I don't know. It was just a weird thing. I don't know. It was a weird thing to say.
I think it's also, like, pointing out the fact that he wasn't letting her in on any of that. So mm-hmm. it's like her knowledge of what was truly happening was skewed.
That's a really, really good point. In Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story, there's a quote that said, by Nazi standards, Fritz Mandl was Jewish, so Hitler was concerned to not be seen with him. I doubt very much that Hitler was a guest in one of their houses, but Mussolini definitely was. End quote.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yikes. Yikes. When Nazi generals visited their home, the conversation focused on weapons, and Hedy listened in, which gave her insight into the Nazi abilities while no one suspected she would understand what they were talking about, simply because she had a vagina.
Oh, that sounds about right.
Interesting. Her husband was constantly paranoid about Hedy's beauty and jealous of the impact that it had on men. That led him to be even more controlling, and it got to the point where he had maids listening into her phone calls and reporting back to him.
Okay, bro, something she can't even help. Like, she was literally born that way.
And isn't that why you wanted her?
Yeah, it's that classic shaming a woman for the things that you love to consume about her. It exactly like Marilyn and the way that people would shame her for mm-hmm. her sexuality and how she showed it, when that's exactly why you like her.
Exactly.
Ooh, I'm feeling spicy today.
I love it. This is why I love when we record in the mornings. We both have more energy. As anyone can imagine and understand, during this time period, her father, who was in Austria, was constantly worried about her.
Rightly so.
Hedy was in a house surrounded by Nazis, married to a man who was working with them and was incredibly controlling. And because she knew of this worry, when her father died suddenly of a heart attack, her outlook on life changed immediately.
Oh.
It is said that Lamar fled her home by bicycle in the middle of the night. There are a lot of different stories that are kind of floating out there. Mm-hmm. There's an NPR article that says it like wasn't super dramatic, that she just kind of like snuck out and drove off. But what Hedy said was that she had hired a maid who looked like her, and specifically had that maid be around during a certain time period, gave the maid some tea that would knock her out, took her clothes and snuck out dressed as a maid with her jewels sewn into her coat like a fucking gangster.
Like a Romanov. I'm only taking that at conjecture that the Romanovs like tried to hide their jewels inside, you know, it's part of the story. But also, can we talk about for a moment if like, and this is coming from her, so think about how desperate she was to get out, that she would drug someone who looks exactly like her to trick everyone else around her into thinking that she was still there so that she could escape in the dead of night.
The thing is even if that's not what happened, even if she's embellishing this story because we get onto her, you know, future drug use and maybe memories are different, maybe she's just embellishing for whatever case, she left a fucking Nazi appeasing asshole and snuck out in the middle of the night. That is huge.
Mm-hmm.
As a Jewish woman.
Yeah. That is a courageous act. Courageous act.
If she also did it with the swagger of sewing her jewels into her coat, that's just extra cherries on this cake of an act. So I just want to throw that out there. I love her telling of it. Either way, she's badass. And so this is 1937. That's when she fled and she goes to London, where she connects with a film agent. And the film agent takes her to a hotel to meet a man she referred to as a little man, who was Louis B. Mayer, the head of MGM.
Was it because he was short, or was it just because that's how she viewed him in personality?
I'm gonna go with both, because he definitely gives off little man Napoleon vibes. Okay. He's kind of an asshole.
All right, overcompensating. I mean,
his last name is Mayer.
But he can't control that.
John Mayer.
Oh, like spelled that way?
Same way. Notorious assholes. Never trust a Mayer man.
Can you tell we're Swifties?
So sorry. I'm not sorry. Okay, sorry. So she meets with this little man Mayer, and he offers her just like a really shitty contract for what she believed, and not believed, for what she knew she was worth.
Mm-hmm.
And she said no and walked out.
Ooh, good for her.
What she did was she hopped on the next like cruise liner boat thing that was going back to New York. And it was the same one that Louis B. Mayer was going to be on. And during this trip back, she made sure that everywhere he was on this ship, she was there too, looking amazing, and made sure that everyone was looking at her.
I love this.
And this took the offer from $125 a week to $500 a week.
Woo!
She spoke very little English, but talked her way into this lucrative contract to act in Hollywood films. The biggest and only issue, as we've seen before, was her name. So they took it from Hedwig to Hedy and Lamar, which means the ocean. She stepped off of this liner into New York with a flash of paparazzi bulbs and her new name, Hedy Lamar. When she first got to the U.S., she was not booking films and was building a lot of anxiety around the scene that she'd done in Ecstasy, thinking it was a black mark preventing her from getting hired. She did meet with a gossip columnist at the time and start spinning the story that she was forced to do this scene and it was perverted by the European filmmakers, which did a little bit to kind of get rid of the black mark. But what really got rid of it was that she happened to meet a man, Charles Boyer, at a party. And from there, she lands a role in his movie coming up, Algiers, where she plays a scam artist involved in the diamond trade. This role and this film made her an instant star. She was amazing in it. Beautiful, carried herself perfectly. She was a fucking star. She was worth the $500 that she had gotten herself a week. My note literally says cue montage of her on every fucking cover of every movie magazine. And at the height of her career, Hedy Lamarr was known as the most beautiful woman in the world. She's an icon. She's a huge star. She's hanging out with anybody who is anybody at the time. JFK before he was married and president. Mm. Howard Hughes, Orson Welles, fucking Picasso. Like, just every great mind of the time, she's hanging out with them. This is where she meets and marries her second husband, who is described as a portly screenwriter and producer, Gene Markey. There is this letter that she wrote to her mom in her mom's in London at this point. We'll get to that later. Where she says, quote, "Dearest mommy, I would never have thought that I could ever fall in love again. Jean has an unbelievable number of traits in common with Dad. So considerate, it's touching. They adopted a son together.
Oh.
And within a couple of months, he begins seeing other actresses like a fucking bitch."
Oh, come on.
So the documentary just kind of like moved on for a little while. And then I was like, what the fuck happened to this child?
Yeah.
So he, it turns out, I guess when they split up or prior to them having been split up, he was a rebellious child.
Okay. which genuinely could mean like so many different things. And
especially
usually
at this
isn't,
time period.
Isn't that rebellious?
No. So they sent him to a military boarding school.
Jesus fuck.
And there's pictures of him looking so young in these little military outfits with those like little fold hats. You know, just like this cute little fucking kid. Like, he looks like a kid on Halloween who's dressed up as a little soldier. And while he's there, he becomes really, really close, and not a bad way, with the sports coach and the sports coach's wife. And he calls up his mom one day and just asks, can I stay with them? And she says yes. And in the documentary towards the end, he said, quote, I never saw her after that for 40 some years.
Wow. If that's where he was happy, then she allowed him to make the correct choice.
Yeah. That's just something to keep in mind. She has a habit of just dropping parts of her that sometimes need to be dropped and sometimes want to be dropped. But a lot of this, plus all of the pressure of being the most beautiful woman in the world, those become reoccurring issues, especially as she gets older. So I just want everyone to kind of remember those blocks of trauma that she's holding on to.
I feel like it's so relatable to want to drop some things as big as that from your life. I'm not necessarily just talking about like an adopted kid, but like any kind of situation that is not healthy for you or serving you in a way that you know is going to be healthy for you and other people that are in that situation. There's something so strong and big in deciding, this is not good. I need to remove myself from this situation.
I was just talking about how I wish I could eternal sunshine for the spotless mind certain traumatic aspects of my life. And that's kind of what she does.
Yeah.
Because, well, this is what's best for her kid. Like, her first child that she loved and raised called her up and said, I want to live with other people. Yeah. And that's trauma for her regardless.
Yeah. No matter how good it is for both of them, that's still got a sting.
Yeah, that's a lot. Hetty was also not happy with the scripts that Louis B. Mayer of MGM was starting to give her. So she petitioned for a role in Boomtown. Mayer was reluctant to give her the role, but it was a huge success that secured her career and an incredibly busy 1940. This year, she was doing film after film, and this wasn't something that was abnormal for actresses at the time. A lot of the talking heads in this documentary talked about how many of the women in that time period were working 6 days a week for a 7-year signed contract, often working into the night and expected to be there the next day. Jesus. Women had to be there earlier than men because they had to get their hair and makeup done. The pressure was higher for women and they were paid less and worked more.
You know what's so crazy? That's all the way back then. Now, still, you have people in the film industry, in the TV industry, who are fighting right now in their unions to make sure that they have safe working hours and are not being overworked in, like, harmful conditions. And it's 2023.
Right?
God damn.
Isn't that so fucking nuts? One of her children said, my mother was worked like a racehorse. She had to run fast all the time. They had pills to wake her up to perform and pills to help her sleep after.
Oh, fuck. It's just sounding a lot like Marilyn.
Yeah. One of the things that honestly probably kept Hetty from the same path as Marilyn Monroe was the fact that she wasn't super interested in partying or socializing. Instead, she spent her nights at home tinkering.
Ooh.
Lamar's favorite hobby involved taking things apart in her home laboratory or in the trailer on set using equipment given to her by Howard Hughes. In between takes, she would be in her trailer taking something apart or creating new designs for Hughes's airplanes.
Wow.
Right?
That's incredible.
Her and Hughes did end up dating, and she also said about him that he was the worst lover she ever had.
Oh, no.
Whether that meant he was a bad boyfriend or he was bad in bed, I'm not sure, and I don't care. I just wanted to include it.
Oh, I'm glad he did.
He gave her great access to all of his airplane factories, because he was like an airplane designer, where he told her, anything you want my scientists to do, just ask them and they'll do it.
What? That's so dope.
In return, she helped him immensely with his airplane designs. And in the interviews from the 90s, she talked about how for a while she pulled out books and started studying the shapes, like the body shapes of birds and fish.
Okay.
And used different birds and the shapes of those to create the right shape for wings and bodies of airplanes.
God, she's so smart.
Just like so fucking cool. So fucking cool. Once things started getting really, really bad in Europe, MGM had all of their actors stop talking about their religious beliefs. But even before that, Hetty had been known to keep her Jewish heritage a complete secret. Even one of her child said, I never heard the word Jewish come from my mother's lips. The Jewish part of her, she just left behind.
That, I mean, that was honestly probably just like a protection mechanism.
Yeah, it makes sense.
You don't know who is going to, who's going to like fuck up your life and put that out there and potentially put you in danger.
And there are also, people are touring, you know, movie people are going around. Mm-hmm. People like the Kennedys were known to be anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
They're also the disgusting concept of being like, well, if they know that our actress is Jewish, they're not going to show this movie in certain parts and it's not going to make money. Disgusting, disgusting, disgusting.
Yeah.
So there's all of these aspects. A lot of it she did for safety and I think to drop the trauma of being married to a man who was supplying weapons so that people could kill people just like you.
I'm so glad you brought him back up. I know she ran away. Did he try to find her? I'm also like, now that she's in the movies and she's so popular, like, does he know where she is?
I'm not sure. He never really came up again.
Interesting.
And I wonder if part of that is because the Nazis kind of looked at the situation and were like, oh, well, now you're not going to have Jewish children.
Okay.
You know, I'm not sure. And I didn't really care to look into it.
Mm-hmm.
But he never came up again.
Glad he didn't try to come after her.
Yeah, seriously. Seriously. And as things were getting really bad in Germany, Hetty became increasingly concerned about getting her mother out of Europe. Her mom was able to flee Austria and get to London, which is how they were writing to each other. But they decided it was best for her to finish the complete trek and join Hetty in America. But she was really nervous about her mom getting on a ship because that same summer of 1940, a shipload of people was torpedoed, killing 293, including 83 children.
Whoa! Whoa!
She's like, shit, it's balancing two horrible situations. Do I let her stay there where it's dangerous, or do I bring her here where getting here could be dangerous?
Holy shit. Yeah. I had no idea that happened.
Right? Isn't that fucking insane?
Yeah.
One of her friends in the documentary said, quote, Hetty being Hetty, she said, I'm going to do something about that, end quote. So she started tinkering her away in that genius brain of her. And the first thoughts led her towards the fact that in order to guide a torpedo, you have to remotely control it. When you shoot it and you need to talk to it again, you have to use the radio. But Nazis can jam the radio frequency. So Hetty was able to come up with a way to communicate with the torpedo that couldn't be interfered or messed with. Mm. Instead of transmitting one frequency on one radio line, she said, what if we change the frequency constantly and consistently in sync with each other, aka frequency hopping?
God, this woman is so fucking smart.
Brilliant. it can't be jammed because you'd only be able to jam one frequency at a time, which would just be one split second of the entire message.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so brilliant.
She is so... I can't even... This is genius.
Right? Robert Price, who's just an asshole and, like, studied secret communications, decided that the only way she could have come up with this is that she heard this idea during the husband's conversations with the Nazis. But if that were the case, then why weren't the Nazis fucking doing it?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Oh my god, it's so hard to believe that a woman could have thoughts.
Fuck you, Robert. So Hetty has this amazing idea, but she isn't fully sure how to make this happen. And then comes George Antheil. He was an American avant-garde composer, and after the two of them met, they just kind of, like, shared their communal hatred for Hitler and the Nazis. Like, what a fucking bond. You meet at a party and you're both like, we fucking hate Hitler and Nazis. Like, let's chat.
Yes.
I love that. Love that. Together, they worked on three inventions, but the most successful was the secret communication system based on the frequency hopping idea that Hetty had.
Yes.
George had no special training in engineering, but what he did know a lot about was working with synchronized pianos and piano rolls.
Oh, okay, this is cool.
So, for those of you who were like me and know nothing about music or any of that shit, think about those pianos you see in, like, old-timey places that have that weird dotted paper that makes them play by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to take two rolls of the same dotted paper and put one into, like, a radio and another one into a radio on a torpedo. The paper rolls would make the radio and transmitter, piano rolls would make the radio and transmitter hop to random frequencies timed perfectly, the way you can synchronize pianos to play songs perfectly.
This is fucking genius,
right? And doing so makes it impossible to jam the communications without holding one of these papers and knowing exactly where, which frequency they're going to be on, and when.
This is so fucking smart.
It is, like, sheer fucking brilliance. So they get connected with someone at Caltech, and he designs the electronic parts, making further strides to get this bad boy created. That happened because she submitted their invention to the National Inventors Council. They liked the idea, connected her with a dude at Caltech, and they got a patent for what they called the secret communication system. They gave the patent free of charge to the United States Navy. Because they were like, use this and fuck up the Nazis.
Here for it.
Amazing.
Let's do something right, Navy.
Right? And the idea is, even though it's donated, it's kind of generally understood that if the military does end up using it, the inventors would be paid.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of this fucking brilliance, the Navy didn't see the importance of what they had just been handed, rejecting the invention and putting it away.
Are they dumb?
They're super dumb, because the thinking is basically, oh, Hetty Lamarr made this, her name's on the patent, you don't get to be Hetty Lamarr the movie star and super smart.
Newsflash, women can do fucking anything.
They can do everything. So they basically were like, okay, honey, go raise some money, go sell war bonds, and leave this stuff to the real inventors.
Once again, the Navy has disappointed me.
Hetty will never, though, because still filled with love for the fight against Nazis, Hetty would often go over and entertain and meet with the soldiers. She sold $25 million in war bonds.
Wow.
Which would be $526 million in today's money.
Jesus!
She was like, all right, like, you know what? You don't want to take my brilliant ideas? Fine. I will give you what you want because I want to help against all of this shit. I want to help. Ooh, I'm like shaking because this is where you're going to get really mad.
Just so disappointed because it's like, would you not try absolutely everything that you possibly can to defeat the fucking Nazis? Like, no matter who it came from? Like, bro.
No, because, like, being super real, America, like, didn't necessarily care about the morality of it, which is why they got involved so late.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
They were like, do we care enough? I don't know.
Because, like, bro, if I were in charge, I would have tried everything that I could to fuck up the Nazis.
Yeah.
Jesus.
So Hedy did all of this, even though she was not yet officially an American citizen. So.
Damn. Look at her out here doing incredible, genius fucking work when she's not even a citizen of the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's how much she cares about people who are being destroyed by a shitty group of subhumans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wow.
After she spent 2 years raising all of this fucking money for them, in 1942, the government seized control of her patent because it was, quote, the property of an enemy alien, end quote.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm like, she raised $25 million in the 1940s, and they took her money and then her patent and called her an enemy alien. Disgusted.
I have no words for how atrocious that is. Bro, she's trying to help you.
She's trying to fight the foe. Fuck you. As if mistreatment from the government wasn't enough, she was also being mistreated at work. Louis B. Mayer continuously tried to keep her on a leash, which she frequently pulled back on, and led her to get the reputation of being a difficult woman to work with.
I was thinking about this last night. A video, and I think I shared it with you, a video of Anne Hathaway came up on TikTok, and it was a video for the UN talking about how much of the mental load and the physical load that women carry at home as caretakers and to not be compensated for that. It was inspiring.
It was.
And then I looked at the comments because I just know that for some reason out there, there's a lot of people who dislike or hate Anne Hathaway, but they can't really tell you why. But they're always like, God, you know, I've never really liked her. Never really been a fan, but like this is so important that she's talking about. She's been a representative of the UN for ages, and she's been speaking out on women's issues for ages. She's not just an actress, but I do think that in her early career, and even still now, she spoke up for herself.
Absolutely.
And is a strong woman, and I think that everyone's first reaction to be like, we don't really like this girl, but we can't tell you why. I think it's one of those things where your first thought is the societally conditioned thought of, oh, this woman is
difficult
because she stood up for herself in a room where, especially in the 90s, early 2000s, it was still a fight. I mean, it's still a fight today to have representation for yourself as a woman, but just 10, 20 years ago, It was even more difficult. And it's so funny seeing those same things from back then in Hedy's time to still now that we're fighting against that narrative of this woman's a bitch, this woman's difficult,
mm-hmm.
because she stands up for herself and what's right for her and other women in the representation that we deserve. Ooh!
Testify. Couldn't have said it better myself. Amazing.
Fuck, I'm spicy this morning.
I wish that we could just end the episode there. But I have more to talk about.
Yeah.
Just replay that whole thing at the end of the episode. Men had spent all of their time in Hedy's life trying to control her. So rather than giving in to Mayer, she went out and produced her own movie in 1946. Studios were not happy about it. Her next love interest was named John Loder. They do end up getting married, and many people described him as too dull for her sparkling diamond.
We can't have someone that overshadows her.
It's not even that he overshadows her, it's that he was... Okay, for my millennials, Hey Arnold. Remember his weird cousin who, like, blinked one eye at a time? That is how I pictured John Loder.
Oh my god.
Just, like, so boring. They did have two kids together, but he ended up leaving her and left her a single mother of two in the 1940s. Fortunately, by this time in her life, Hedy's mom had made it out to the U.S. and to California and was living near Hedy and helping her with her children.
Nice. I love that.
Right? Her next film came just at the right time, where she played Delilah in Samson and Delilah in 1949, bringing Hedy's almost-ending career right back to the top. The only movie that could surpass this was Gone with the Wind, like in sales and in fame. That's at the time. This was the best movie. because the movie that she had produced prior to Delilah and Samson had, like, done okay, she attempted to make another movie, but that took all of her money for a production that was way out of her skill set. By 1954, she meets oil tycoon Howard Lee and moves to Texas with her children. But Brilliant Hetty had not much to do there beyond being a trophy wife, which led her mind to wander to the idea of building a ski resort in Aspen.
Okay, girl.
This resort succeeded immensely, but as it did, her marriage dwindled. Her husband was drinking a lot, further making a difficult marriage even worse. They separated, and all she really wanted was Aspen. She had poured her heart and soul into designing very, like, European, Austrian-esque ski resorts that was making, like, $1 million a day or, like, something ridiculous. It was bringing in so much money, and that's oh, she was like, God, take everything else. That's, I just want Aspen. So during the divorce proceedings, her son, Anthony, was in the hospital after an accident, like near death. And she made the bad decision in her stress and anxiety to send her studio body double to court so that she could stay with her child.
Oh no!
Which I think we can all understand wanting to stay with her kid, who did end up living. Who did end up living.
I just already know where this is going.
The judge retaliated this stunt by cutting her entire settlement, once again leaving Hetty with almost nothing. Her son said, "My mother had two more husbands in her life, neither of which lasted longer than a year."
I'm still stuck on this judge. I'm so sorry.
Oh, understandably.
I know it's a product of the time, but, like, she was with her injured fucking child. Why was her husband not with the injured fucking child?
I genuinely feel like had she not shown up and not sent the body double, she would have gotten the entire settlement. But I think the judge was, like, pissed at, like, "You're trying to trick me." But it's genuinely just like, no, I feel like I legally am supposed to be there, but, like, my kid might be dying. I'm not leaving.
Because I'm out here like, oh, okay, she made the right choice to stay with her fucking kid.
I don't think she regretted it. She didn't get Aspen. She lost everything, but, like, she was there for her kid.
Yeah.
So I don't think she regretted it. Still, all of this trauma, Hetty's not having a good time. So it's 1950. Here comes just a reoccurring fucking character in our lives, Dr. Feelgood, Max Jacobson. Why are you everywhere?
Everywhere. So many episodes.
Just all.
So many different things.
He's all over. I'd love to see the airfare of this guy. She's out in Texas and California. He's everywhere. So Hetty became a patient from Dr. Feelgood, Max Jacobson, from 1950 literally up until Jacobson lost his medical license in 1974. She was with him the whole time.
Wow.
In the 1990s interview, she says, quote, "He gave me the shot. I didn't know what it was. I thought it was vitamins," end quote. Well,
that sounds familiar.
And then a quote almost immediately followed it up with someone saying he loaded up the vial with 40 milligrams of methamphetamine, end quote.
Damn!
And this was when meth was legal, but that doesn't matter because it still led to incredibly erratic, occasionally abusive behavior at home that her children had to endure, as well as a full-blown addiction.
Jesus.
All of that is happening around the time, like, it's the 1960s now, and by the time that rolled around, the previous characters that she had played were now in the prime age to be made fun of and mocked by popular culture. It's what happens. Everyone starts, like, making jokes about the prime of the generation before them, and it's sort of the cycle of fame, unless you die, really. And then even still, sometimes you're still made fun of a la Marilyn Monroe. So it's... But the fact that it was happening while she's dealing with this addiction, being the butt of the joke at a time of battling addiction and dealing with trauma, doesn't bode well for a person. She then has sort of a public incident of shoplifting where she's arrested and she is acquitted because she said that she had, like, picked something up and thought she put it down and just walked out of the store with it. But she was arrested with, like, thousands of dollars on her, as well as, like, $80 of merchandise, and, like, hadn't bought anything. So it's just, like, it didn't look good.
Yeah.
And this shoplifting incident just sort of solidified her spot as the punchline of the time period, to the point where Andy Warhol's School of Film makes a whole short film about the shoplifting incident where she is just a full-on joke.
I know everybody loves Andy Warhol, but like...
Oh, he was a mean girl.
I was gonna say, learn more about him because he was a mean-ass bitch.
He basically killed Edie Sedgwick, and when I have the emotional capacity to do that episode, I will, but him, it's his fault and Bob Dylan's fault, and that is the hill. Like, dig my grave, I'll die here. She's this full-on joke. She's then fired for, like, the last role that she had been hired for, and she's replaced by Zsa Zsa Gabor. It's 1969, and everything kind of fell apart for her. And the really only thing that she was holding on to at that time is trying to figure out what had happened with her old patent.
Okay.
She reaches out to a friend of hers in the Navy to try to, like, track that down. And while his exact reply has been lost to time, she most likely learned that her idea of frequency hopping was being used. Quote, by the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when JFK sent Navy ships to block Cuba, the ships that were running the block were all equipped with frequency hopping radios, end quote. Eddie was like, what's up, Navy? Pay me. And they said no, because we don't have to. The patent expired in 1959, and that's when we started using it.
Are you fucking...
So
let's talk about the fact that they did love the idea originally, and they were just like, we don't want to pay her, so we're just going to wait.
They didn't start using it until 1955, which is before it expired, and we're gonna talk about what happened, because they put the idea away. But after the war, the Navy was interested in developing something known as the sonobuoy. So it's a buoy that sits in the water and is checking out what's going on around them and detecting possible submarine activity below it. And they wanted to be able to send a jam-proof signal to the airplane overhead about what was going on.
Okay.
So when that happened, the engineer who was working on that went and found the frequency hopping patent and all of that stuff. But by that time, it had already been seized by the government as property from an enemy alien and put through so many different things that Hetty's name had been essentially completely washed from it entirely. It was just like a military thing now.
You know, not a fan of the government.
Because of the guy who invented that, the piece that used the frequency hopping technology, he now has a website where he credits Hetty with the technology that he built this off of.
Dope.
The thing that's crazy frustrating is that according to U.S. patent law of the time, when the patent expired, the inventor had 6 years to sue for payment, but Hetty didn't know that. And there's a written statement from the engineer saying he designed the buoy, one of the first uses of frequency hopping, giving a belated thank you to Hetty Lamarr for this impressive piece of technology.
So even the guy, he is outright saying it was her.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And they never paid her.
Yeah. How are you going to know? Especially if you don't know that they're using it, how are you supposed to know about the 6 year thing? You don't know that they're using it.
Author Richard Rhodes says, quote, however, in the 1990s, when Hetty was in her early 80s, one of the pioneers of wireless communications for computers came across all the information and realized that Hetty had never been honored for her invention. And that started the ball rolling so that one of the major communications organizations would give her credit during one of its annual awards, end quote. Hetty sent her son, because back to the fact that society has such an immense issue with women aging in general, but the pressure is amplified when you are famous for being the most beautiful woman in the world.
Yeah.
She's 86. She's battled addiction and all of this stuff. And in the late years of her life, she really became a recluse.
Can you blame her?
No. As she aged, she got a lot of plastic surgery, with many of the doctors say the ideas that she came up with for her plastic surgery, such as putting specific scars behind her ear, behind her knee, and like the placement of certain things, was like groundbreaking. So all of her ideas, just groundbreaking. But as she continued to age, she got more and more plastic surgery, which often offered poor results. And as the money started to run out, she was living off of residuals and Social Security, which ended up being around $300 a month. She became such a recluse in her later years to the point where she only met her granddaughter 2 times in her granddaughter's life, but would send autographed young photos of her for like holidays and stuff. It's so sad. And as the ball was rolling of getting her credit for her invention, they called her for her award, and her first words were, "Well, it's about time." Hetty's idea for frequency hopping is still the basis for secure Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, cell phones, GPS, and loads of military technology. And according to the Bombshell documentary made in 2017, the market value for her invention is over $30 billion. Regardless, to this day, neither Lamar nor her estate have seen a cent from this multi-billion dollar industry based off of her idea.
Damn, dude.
And that is Hetty Lamar's story.
That woman deserves everything. So much more credit. Yeah, literally everything. It's just another story of an extremely overqualified woman being put down by mediocre men.
Oh, right? Always. It's always that. Why is it always that?
Man, the patriarchy hurts us all. It hurts us all. Hear me when I say it. It does not just hurt women. It hurts us all.
Seriously.
Woo, Katie, thank you so much. I mean, shit. See, I'm excited that you did this episode because I knew about her inventions. And to be very honest with everyone, because of the same fucking Tumblr posts that I would see every Women's History Month. Mm. But I actually didn't know anything about her movie career or her early life. I had no idea.
An arms dealer.
An arms dealer for the fucking Nazis. Like, I'm so glad that you chose to talk about her this week.
It felt right.
Yeah. Thank you so, so much.
Anytime. Until next week, y'all.
We'll see you later.
Bye.
Bye.
For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2KPodcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at AL2KPodcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
Join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/AL2KPodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thanks for listening.